Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today, I just want to take a quick look at the Germans again, at Hitler and his people, regarding a certain topic. And I just want to show you a few things that will clarify in your mind how Hitler saw the past and where he was drawing his lessons from. Just remember that Hitler spent a lot of time reading. He read like crazy, and he did it from when he was young. So Hitler read everything that he could, and he boasted that he'd read every single book in the library at Linz, the small Austrian town where he grew up. And people like Leon de Grel, who met him and stayed with him for a couple of days, Leon de Grel tells you that Hitler read books like crazy. Hitler looked at a different book every day, and he went and studied it and moved on. And he read on every single topic that he possibly could, from science, archaeology, astronomy, history, engineering, religion, philosophy, you name it, Hitler read it. But when it came to formulating policy for his state and for the Germans and figuring out the best ways forward, Hitler looked at history to see what you can learn from history. And of course, we, the European people, we have got an insanely rich history. Our history is so fantastic. There is so much in our history. I personally cannot understand that you need to go to freaking Jews and find out what Jews know, because they know nothing compared to what our ancestors and forefathers know. There is nothing Jews or anybody else can teach us. Everything you can imagine is sitting in our history. And our people have been literally everywhere and done literally everything that you can do. And it's documented. So Hitler drew from European history, and his knowledge was vast. But we in the modern times, we have had our heads filled with so much other rubbish that we've not really looked at our history properly. And we cannot draw accurate information out of our history as normal people. Academics who spend all their lives studying archaeology and history, they can pick up certain things and reach certain conclusions. But the average common person doesn't really know enough about history. They can just look at a few pictures, and those pictures don't say much, and it doesn't mean much. If I had to say to you, what is the difference between the ancient Greeks and the Celts, or the Romans and the Gauls, you wouldn't really be able to come up with too many things. Probably the main thing you'd look at are your visual impressions. What did they wear? The Gauls had swords and shields. They had round shields. And the Romans had square shields, and it looks pretty much similar. And maybe they are slightly differently dressed, etc. But in reality, our ancestors were much, much more complex, and they were much deeper to understand. And their societies were functional societies which had their own thoughts. So the Gauls, for example, would have a certain kind of culture, and they would believe certain things, and their laws would cover certain issues. And then you'd have the Germans or the Britons, and they would be slightly different in other ways. In some areas, there were a lot of differences. In other areas, there were few differences. But in ancient times, like in modern times, whites are complicated. And whites who settle in different places start having different thoughts, and they develop all kinds of thoughts and concepts and ways of living. you must never make the mistake that I've made, because I live in Africa and I see these black Stone Age people and I'm used to their total dysfunctionality. When I was at school and we were taught about the Romans and that it was a case of the Romans versus the barbarians, I used to think that the barbarians, the quotes, white barbarians, were like the blacks in Africa because they seemed to live in villages, and I thought, those people were really, really backward. But the reality is all of our ancestors were way more functional than even modern Africans. That is a topic I will return to. In terms of society, how it functioned, as well as engineering, economics, military, government, etc., you would be amazed at the sophistication of our ancestors, all of them. They had very, very functional, rule-based societies, all of them, whether they were German pagans, whether they were Celts, whether they were Britons, they all had very functional societies. They could not be compared to third worlders in the modern time. I'm not joking with you. I want to return to this and I'll show you all kinds of really interesting things. But the key issue here today is Hitler's view on the past and Hitler and the Romans and Hitler and the Germans, the ancient German tribesmen. How did Hitler see these previous whites? What I'm going to be reading from is a relatively modern book. It is actually about the Church of Creativity. It's the only history that I could find, written by the enemy, of course. It's the only history I could find of the Church of Creativity, of Ben Klassen's people. And it's called Theology of Hate, A History of the World Church of the Creator. And what I want to read to you from is an interesting page, page 44. 44 onto the beginning of 45. Because the guy is writing about Hitler and Hitler's views. So it says this: nevertheless, Hitler did seem to believe that the martial qualities of some pagan religions made them superior to Christianity. In one of the table talks, numerous discussions between Hitler and his intimate associates that Martin Bormann persuaded Hitler to be taken down by shorthand writers, Hitler praised the Shinto religion of the Japanese for its cult of heroism. Still, he was not interested in reviving paganism in Germany. There is some evidence that Hitler was interested in the old Norse legends and the occult. However, he remained contemptuous of the individual occultists and their esoteric elitism. The only high-ranking person within the Nazi hierarchy who seriously considered making paganism a mass movement was SS Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler. However, Hitler was dismissive of Himmler's mysticism and rejected his idea for establishing a new religion. Even the party's other pagans considered Himmler's views bizarre. Unlike the neo-pagans, Himmler was not particularly enthusiastic about dramatizing the early Germanic period in Europe. Although Himmler was eager to underwrite such projects, Hitler was not interested in such endeavors, much to Himmler's despair. In a conversation he once had with Albert Speer, Hitler stressed that the excavations in search of ancient artifacts of the Aryan race sponsored by the Anerba division of the SS were misguided. So listen to this. Why do we force the whole world to know that we have no past? As if it were not enough that the Romans were already constructing great edifices while our ancestors were still living in clay huts. Himmler is now starting to dig up those clay villages and becomes enthusiastic about every clay potsherd and every stone axe he finds. The only thing he proves is that we still threw stone hatchets and squatted by open fires at a time when Greece and Rome had reached the highest cultural level. We really have every reason to be quiet about that age. So that is an interesting quote. Now, to find that quote was very difficult, but I'll point you to the sources that this book is referencing. I don't have all the books that are mentioned in here, but I will tell you which things come from where. So the one reference is reference 41, and it says, in his memoirs, Himmler's physician, Dr. Kirsten, mentioned that Himmler confided to him his desire to make paganism the official religion of Europe, and this is fun, and hang the Pope after German victory in World War II. So that was Himmler's plan, hang the Pope and turn all of Europe pagan again. The other reference, another reference, because there are several references which result in this piece that I read to you. The other reference is from a book called Nazism and the Revival of Political Religion Theory. Then there's another one, The Master Plan, Himmler's Scholars and the Holocaust, page 146. Himmler came under the influence of Karl Willigut, an important figure in the Anerba, the ancestral division of the SS. Willigut designed much of the paraphernalia of the SS, including the SS dagger and rings. Okay, then another one is reference 44. The primary purpose of the Anerba division was to investigate German prehistory. For more on the organization, see the master plan. There was a division of the SS, this Anerba division, and it was basically the SS digging into history. That's what it boiled down to. When I look at the past, it boils down to this. Because of Hitler's self-education, Hitler had formulated many ideas, and there were many ideas and thoughts that Hitler had that had come from his massive reading and massive thinking. And now that he's in power, now they are looking at some of his things, especially Himmler and the SS, because the SS is a racial organization. What the SS is there for is to create an elite class of white men and women. This elite is going to run the show in the future, and they are busy gathering all sorts of people and all sorts of skills. And it also includes scientists. Now, of course, all the Jews and the liberals poo-poo the scientific aspect of things. So they diss the SS and they say nasty things about Himmler. But the simple fact is that Hitler was very impressed with the Aryans, and now the SS has come up with the idea to form an organization that is going to dig into the history of the Germans. And basically what they're looking for is to find a way to see if German prehistory intersects with the Aryans at some point in time. So that's the real goal here. They're all looking up to the Aryans, whom Hitler has tremendous respect for, and they now want to try and see what they can find from archaeology. And this organization, by the way, this Anerbe division, is not government funded. It is actually privately funded, and they work out a bunch of things to try and get it some funds so it can run. And this organization initially has got a guy that's a little bit wild, and then they get rid of him, and then they get another guy, and they are trying to see what they can do. And they later on send people to different parts of Europe, etc., in order to try to find evidence for this link. I'm just going to read you a short summary, basically, of what they did. Archaeological expeditions. The Anerbe conducted various archaeological expeditions across Europe and beyond, including in Germany, Scandinavia, the Near East, and Tibet. These expeditions aimed to find artifacts and sites that could be interpreted as evidence of an ancient Aryan civilization. Excavation and research. In Germany, the Anerbe conducted excavations at several prehistoric and medieval sites. They searched for evidence of early Germanic tribes and their supposed connection to Aryan ancestors. In France, they investigated the cave paintings in the Dordogne region, trying to link them to the Aryans. Expeditions to Iceland and Finland focused on finding traces of ancient Germanic paganism. So that'll give you a little bit of an idea of what was going on here. What I wanted to do, because this book was written by one of our enemies, I just wanted to be 100% sure that what I'm telling you Hitler said is actually true. This book, by the way, is not a bad book at all. It is written by an academic, and although he's against creativity and Hitler and the Nazis, the book does have lots of good references in it, and he quotes, including from good stuff, good solid stuff, like Leon de Grelle, which I have gone through. So he does have good solid quotes, and I don't doubt the accuracy of his references. But just to be 100% sure, I wanted to see what I could find out of my collection of stuff. And believe it or not, to my amazement, after quite a lot of searching, I actually can find the real quote where Hitler talks. But let's just jump around a little bit about some of the things that Hitler said. So, with reference to Hitler talking about the Japanese, if we go to Hitler's table talk, 13th December 1941, midday, it is here that I find a reference to the Japanese. In the table talk, I cannot find a reference to the Shinto religion, no, but I can find references to the Japanese. So it says the following. Hitler says, for 30 years, and what he's referring to is the 30 Years' War. Remember, the 30 Years' War was like a Christian world war that was fought on German territory among Germans and other Europeans. It was a hectic war. So that's what he's referring to. For 30 years, the Germans tore each other to pieces simply in order to know whether or not they should take communion in both kinds. There's nothing lower than religious notions like that. From that point of view, one can envy the Japanese. They have a religion which is very simple and brings them into contact with nature. So that's the one reference that I can find about that. Then in Hitler's table talk, the one I've got has got an error, and it's something April 1942 at dinner. And here what it says is, It is not surprising that this should be so, for the religion of the Japanese is above all a cult of heroism, and its heroes are those who do not hesitate to sacrifice their lives for the glory and safety of their country. Then he goes on to say the Christians, on the other hand, prefer to honor the saints. But the point here is that the Japanese have got a cult of heroism, and they will not hesitate to sacrifice their lives for the glory and safety of their country. And that ties back to that other book that speaks about the Japanese and their religion and heroism being an important value. Then I did manage to find the exact quote that this book was referring to, and I found it in Albert Speer's book, Inside the Third Reich. And I actually want to read quite a chunk here. You'll see that this is similar to what was written in this other book, but I like reading what the Germans wrote. So, it starts like this. Thus, Hitler had little sympathy with Himmler in his mythologizing of the SS. And this is now what Hitler is saying. What nonsense. Here we have at last reached an age that has left all mysticism behind it, and now he wants to start that all over again. We might as well have stayed with the church. At least it had tradition. To think that I may someday be turned into an SS saint. Can you imagine it? I would turn over in my grave. Himmler has made another speech calling Charlemagne the butcher of the Saxons. Killing all those Saxons was not a historical crime, as Himmler thinks. Charlemagne did a good thing in subjugating, Widukind, and killing the Saxons out of hand. He thereby made possible the empire of the Franks and the entry of Western culture into what is now Germany. So there's an interesting thing that Hitler says about the slaughter of the Saxons by the Christians. Hitler doesn't have a problem with it. Then it continues. Himmler had scientists undertake excavations of prehistoric sites. Hitler commented, "Why do we call the world's attention to the fact that we have no past? It isn't enough that the Romans were erecting great buildings when our forefathers were still living in mud huts. Now Himmler is starting to dig up these villages of mud huts and enthusing over every potsherd and stone axe he finds. All we prove by this is that we were still throwing stone hatchets and crouching around open fires when Greece and Rome had already reached the highest stage of culture. We really should do our best to keep quiet about this past. Instead, Himmler makes a great fuss about it all. The present day Romans must be having a laugh at these revelations." So there we can see that Hitler definitely did say these things, and it's very interesting. It comes from Albert Speer. So the issue at hand is that Hitler is looking at the Romans and the Greeks, and he's very impressed with the high standards of their civilization and culture that they've achieved. Meanwhile, the German pagans are living in mud huts. I'm not sure if they can write, and they definitely don't have science in the way that the Greeks and Romans have it. You must remember that the Greeks were doing mathematics and the Greeks were doing science, and the Romans learned all their stuff from the Greeks. That's a very important point, that as the Romans rose up from a small group of people until they started becoming a power, the Romans actually went and studied what the Greeks did. They learned from the Greeks. So you must see Roman civilization as something that is built on top of Greek knowledge. And this is Greek mathematics, Greek engineering, Greek science, all the deep thinking. The Greeks are amazing as a civilization. The Greeks are incredibly amazing as a small group of whites who are insanely clever. And the things that these ancient Greeks come up with and their application of logic is amazing. I'm not fully sure where they found it all. I think that a lot of what they had, they invented themselves. I don't think they even picked it up from other civilizations. But I'm not an expert on this. But all I'm saying is that the writings and the thoughts of the Greeks were very, very deep. They were insanely clever. And they weren't such a big set of nations. They were small nations with not big populations. And the things that these ancient Greeks came up with is astounding. Their engineering and their investigation of mechanical devices and things is quite stunning. Their mathematics is amazing. And the ancient Greeks even measured the circumference of the earth. I have had discussions with people who believed in flat earth, and I've told them that you will not find our ancestors. Our ancestors did not think the earth was flat. At least the Romans and the Greeks definitely did not. They knew the earth was round, and the Greeks even measured the diameter of the earth. The diameter of the earth was first measured amazingly accurately by a Greek guy called Eratosthenes. Eratosthenes worked out an experiment of how he could measure the diameter of the earth. And it involved him taking measurements in Greece, traveling south to Egypt, and then taking measurements in Egypt on the exact day of the year that matched the day when he took the measurements in Greece. Eratosthenes is the first guy to measure damn accurately the diameter of the earth. He knew it. And the ancients knew all kinds of things. They knew about the roundness of the moon and all those things. They looked at things like eclipses. They knew that what you are looking at is a shadow that is falling on the moon. Man, they were sharp, okay? They knew tons of stuff. They deduced lots of things. But this knowledge is sitting in southern Europe. It's sitting in Greece, and it's sitting in the Roman Empire. And this makes for a very interesting question. The question being, how is it that European civilization actually starts in the south of Europe? Why is it that Greece and Rome are really the earliest of the major European civilizations that come into being in Europe? Why isn't it happening in Germany? Why isn't it happening in France or Britain or in Ukraine? Or Poland, why isn't it happening there? Just take a look at the screen in front of you, because what you'll see is a series of maps of Europe. And this may help to explain why civilization in Europe started in the south. What those four maps are maps of the tree line in Europe. You must remember that Europe went through ice ages, and Europe went through lots of ice ages. And some were longer and some were shorter. They were hectic. And these ice ages resulted in glaciers covering Europe. And so Europe didn't have any trees. Now, we had ancestors who did live in those glaciers and who did live in parts of Europe in the past. But you must remember that there were two things that happened in the past. Not only were there glaciers, but also the people who lived there were hunter-gatherers. So they had to hunt animals and they lived in caves. These people were extremely fit and healthy, but their populations were small. And what happened is that the trees only came back to Europe when the Ice Age, the last Ice Age, ended 20,000 years ago. So what this map is showing you is that 12,000 years ago, there were no trees in what is now France, Germany, Britain, Scandinavia, etc. Zero trees. And this is what scientists have picked up, obviously, from their studies. They can prove how old the trees were from the things that they've been able to find. So the first trees coming into Europe only started appearing like 12,000 years ago, maybe a little bit sooner. Now take a look on the top left map. This is 12,000 years before present. And before present, I learned, is 1950. It's a date set by scientists to do with radiocarbon dating. So when you look at this map, you'll see an interesting thing. Notice that the most trees that exist in Europe are actually in what became ancient Greece. And before Greece, there was another little civilization, and that civilization was Crete. So look in the bottom right of that map. You'll see that the bottom of Greece is very dark green. And then to the southeast of Greece is Crete. And look at Crete. It is also dark green. And from what I understand from history, there was a early civilization on Crete before there was a civilization in Greece. And then you had the Romans. So it could well be that the population of whites was greater in the south because of the climate, and that you did have whites to the further north, but they weren't many. Their populations could have been very sparse. And so when you read Roman history and Greek history, you'll be amazed at how much activity is going on in Greece, Italy, and Spain. Spain is a very active place as well during the time of the Romans. And another thing that happens is that farmers move in to Europe and settle. And when farmers move in, the population goes up, because the farmers create more food, they grow more food than they need, and the populations can grow fast. So keep in mind, whites have technically been in Europe for 40 to 45,000 years, but the tree lines only started coming up in the last 12,000 years. And then you can see that by 10,000 years, you can see that Greece has got lots of trees, Italy's got lots of trees, Spain's got lots of trees. And you can see that if you go to the map on the bottom left, you'll see that by 6,000 years ago, trees have reached Britain, Ireland, and trees have reached the bottom of Scandinavia. But trees have been, at that point, trees have been in Greece and Italy for 6,000 years, but there are no trees in Scandinavia. So trees have been on the bottom of Europe for 6,000 years, but there are still no trees in Scandinavia. And then you can see the final map, the one in the bottom right. This is 2,000 years ago. So this is 2,000 years ago at the time of the Romans. And you can see that the bottom of Italy has got a lot of vegetation. There's a lot of vegetation in Greece, in Spain, south of France is starting to pick up. But you'll see that there's a lot less trees as you go further north. Trees are much more sparse in some of those other areas. And that should give you an idea that the number of whites in Europe, the population of the whites, may have had a longer time to build up in the south, and also they started earlier and their climate is better. And that could well explain why the whites in the north, they exist and they are there, but they haven't had as much time to build up and develop as the whites in the south of Europe. And in the south of Europe, they've had a long, long period of time to build up their history. Now, if we look at 2,000 years ago, that's the time when the Romans were very active. But the Greeks were active hundreds of years before. There's almost another 1,000 years prior to the Romans, where there's lots of other activity going on. There's lots of other activity going on in the Middle East, for example. And then if you go further south to Egypt, the Egyptian civilization, which whites also started, the Egyptian civilization has been running for 3,000 and 4,000 years. So this could explain why Europeans are behind the Middle East and North Africa, is because of the climate. The climate is nasty, nasty, nasty. There are no trees. There's a lack of people, etc. So just sit and ponder this, because this could give you some insight into why the whites who are in the north, why they haven't built big civilizations, because there aren't many of them, and the climate has been nasty, 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 whereas the whites in the southern part are in a much better position. Plus, there are still Middle Eastern civilizations where whites may have played a role in all of them. There were, for example, Hittites. Hittites, I know for a fact, in the Middle East, Hittites were pure whites, and they lived in what is now Syria. And they had a civilization long time ago. The Hittites, for example, existed from 1600 BC to 1100 BC. In other words, the Hittites in what is now more or less Syria and Turkey and those places, those whites had a civilization like 1,000 years before the Romans. 1,000 years before the Romans. And if you look at the movement of peoples into Europe, the movement of peoples into Europe starts speeding up round about 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. So that would explain why civilization starts taking off more in the south than in the north. It's got to do with numbers of people, climate, and the ability to build up numbers and settle down and start, you know, getting down and developing over a period of time. The whites in the south had the edge, and it looks like it's mainly due to climate. Climate is the real thing. And just keep in mind that even before those European civilizations, there was already the Egyptian civilization in North Africa. So they're in Egypt. So the Egyptian civilization was like a long running thing that existed for thousands of years. I think in total it existed for close to like 5,000 years. It was a much slower sort of a thing. Whereas when these other whites like the Greeks and the Romans and the Cretans started coming into play, civilization and the rate of progress speeded up. Things moved a lot faster. So just keep this in the back of your mind whenever you think about Europe and North versus South, because this is definitely an issue. I just want to comment on a number of issues. The first thing you must keep in mind about the Nazis is that due to Hitler's piles and piles of new knowledge and his deep knowledge, he's got ideas and theories and thoughts, all kinds of thoughts. And he's extremely impressed with the Aryans. He's no doubt read things like the Rig Veda and all that other stuff that comes from ancient Indo-European sources. And so he's idolizing the Aryans because the Aryans went and conquered all that territory up in India, conquered and took over in the north of India. It was an amazing thing. And so now all these guys are thinking about big things. They are asking questions about science, about Christianity. What should they be doing for Germany? And you get guys who are thinking that, you know, maybe the Germans need a German religion. Maybe there should be a Germanic religion. And then you get guys like Alfred Rosenberg, who's written the book, The Myth of the 20th Century. I've gone through that book quite a lot, but it is one heck of a hard read. It's not a book that impresses me that much. And I have seen where others comment on it and they say it's unreadable. Rosenberg was trying to come up with some kind of religion. So they are thinking big thoughts. And here's Himmler, and he's also starting to think, and he's starting to say, well, you know, maybe we should go back to paganism. But it's very interesting. It's very interesting to see Hitler's comments that Hitler does not like the idea of mysticism. He doesn't like the idea of mysticism. Hitler does not like the idea of moving away from logic. That's a very important takeaway from that. I want to just go and read that little section again, where Hitler says, "What nonsense! Here we have at last reached an age that has left all mysticism behind it. And now he, Himmler, wants to start that all over again. We might just as well have stayed with the church. At least it had tradition. To think that I may someday be turned into an SS saint. Can you imagine it? I would turn over in my grave." So that is a pretty wild thing to say there. But it's very important there to see Hitler's attitude. Hitler is not interested in mystical, mysterious, other kinds of thinking. Hitler likes logic. Hitler likes logic. He's a clear thinker. What is quite surprising, very surprising, is Hitler saying the opposite of Himmler regarding the killing of the Saxons, because the Christians went and massacred Saxons. But listen to Hitler's logic, where Hitler says, "Himmler has made another speech calling Charlemagne, who was a Christian, he was one of the first big-time Christian rulers, and he basically created what was known as the Holy Roman Empire. It was an attempt to sort of bring back a kind of Roman Empire, but under Christianity." So at a point, Charlemagne goes and slaughters thousands of whites, Saxons. And so here, Hitler says, "Himmler has made another speech calling Charlemagne the butcher of the Saxons. Killing all those Saxons was not a historical crime, as Himmler thinks. Charlemagne did a good thing in subjugating, Widukind, and killing the Saxons out of hand. He thereby made possible the empire of the Franks and the entry of Western culture into what is now Germany." So there's a real line of thinking there where Hitler is saying, where Hitler is not even worried about the killing of other whites, where he's saying, look, Charlemagne is creating something big. And by getting Widukind out of the way, Widukind and his people out of the way, It allows Charlemagne to create the empire of the Franks, and Western culture is now going to head into Germany. So it's like Hitler is more concerned that finally Western culture enters Germany. He sees it as positive that the Germans are going to be changed by this Christian Charlemagne. How is that, eh? That is a very interesting way of looking at it. Hitler is definitely a big picture kind of a guy. He's not too worried about all kinds of other smaller things, even the slaughter of a couple of thousand whites. He is more concerned about the big picture. Was Charlemagne doing a good thing, even though Charlemagne's a Christian? Well, Hitler says what's really important is that Western culture is moving into Germany. And it's clear from these discussions where Hitler uses the term culture, like when he was using the term culture with the Romans and the Greeks, where he said they attained a high culture, that Hitler's talking about science and knowledge. He's not just talking about the way they dress or something like that. He's talking about everything. He is talking about knowledge and the way we do things and how our knowledge and science works, how our entire system works. So that is very interesting, very, very interesting how Hitler sees that, where he says what's really important is that Western culture got into Germany. So keep in mind that guys like Himmler, there are lots of good guys at a high level in Hitler's circles. Himmler's a good guy. He's a nice guy. Rudolf Hess is a nice guy, genuine guy. But they do not have the tremendous knowledge that Hitler has. Hitler's knowledge is mega knowledge. It is massive. And he's not only got knowledge, but he's got the sort of finer tuning of how to use that knowledge. So Himmler's doing the best that he thinks, but Hitler's looking at it, and Hitler has additional knowledge, and then he says, look, man, Himmler shouldn't be saying that. He is wasting his time on that kind of thing. But he's not going to go out and smack Himmler. Himmler gets to say what he wants to say. Hitler's not happy about it, but he's not going to make a big deal about it. He, in his own turn, will say what he wants to say. So there are all these kinds of things about what were they going to do. Should they go back to paganism? Should they invent a religion for Germans? Should they keep Christianity? Should they modify Christianity? There are all these things. And for the most part, Hitler actually steps back from getting rid of Christianity, and he just engages Christianity with positive Christianity. So he says, look, we get the Christians to work with us, we work with them, we be nice to each other, and we carry on, and leave the religion stuff alone. Hitler basically leaves Christianity alone for it to go where it will go in the future. He is not a Christian, but he's not going to change it now. Later on in Hitler's table talk, he does take some nastier swipes at Christianity. But it should be clear that Hitler's not on a crusade to get rid of Christianity. He's not on a crusade to create a religion. He doesn't see those things as being that important that he needs to intervene there now. He is happy to continue with what they've got and let some things be. You must keep in mind that Hitler and Goebbels are two really great thinkers on the Nazi side. About Himmler, what I've kind of picked up about Himmler from the various memoirs I've gone through, Himmler's actually just a nice guy. Himmler's not a nasty guy. He's a nice guy. He takes his position seriously. He's trying to do the best that he can for the European race. As a person and as a human being, he's actually a pretty decent bloke. He's a pleasant guy. He's a nice man. I remember in one of the memoirs of one of the generals, I can't remember which one now, but he was talking about meeting Himmler towards the end of the war, and he had his issues with the orders that Hitler was giving. And he found that Himmler was a really open-minded guy, and that Himmler would let him speak. And Himmler would even turn around and say, you know what, I actually agree with you. I disagree with Hitler on this. I agree with you that Hitler's wrong. So Himmler is actually a pretty decent bloke. He's a nice guy. He is maybe softer than Hitler and softer than Goebbels, but he's a nice bloke. And I also read something a long time ago where Himmler's daughter, who lived after the war, Himmler's daughter spoke about her father, and she said he was a really, really nice man. So Himmler's not committing a crime. Himmler's just being himself. He's doing the best he can. He's trying to make the most of what he thinks is right. It's not a big deal. It really isn't a big deal. He's trying to turn the SS into something very special, and he's trying to cover all his different bases. And it's just that he's on a bit of a mission where he thinks that mystical stuff is going to be of use, but Hitler's not interested. Hitler is a logical guy, and Hitler actually says, let's not return to mysticism and esoteric stuff and all this other funny business. Let's not go back there. We don't want to go back into what we were in the past. We want to function on logic. We want to function on facts. So although that division tried to find evidence, they couldn't really find evidence. But now, decades later, with American and European academics digging deeply into the past, we now know that there is an Indo-European link in terms of language. And the most interesting thing that I heard from my Bulgarian friend Georgi is that I think in Bulgaria they discovered the oldest chariot wheels that they've ever found. And he was saying that it looks like the Aryans actually came from Bulgaria. So again, you're back to that Southern Europe thing, that if there were whites who developed new technology, it sounds much more doable that it came from Southern Europe, and that those are the whites who developed the chariot technology that became the thing that created the Aryan military power that later on went on to conquer India. So it might even be that the Aryans started inside Europe, but it's more like Southern and Eastern Europe is where it may have come from. So keep in mind that climate advantage of Southern Europe. And also, the peoples that are migrating into Europe are coming from the East, and they often enter the more southern parts of Europe. There's a lot of stuff that goes on over thousands of years. The key point is that Hitler believes in logic, and Hitler is looking for the best achievers of the past, because Hitler is looking to build things in the future, and the things that he's building, he wants to build it based on actual historical experience. What system works best? And the Greeks and the Romans are the leaders in this area. And then, of course, the Romans go on to be top of the pops. The Romans go on to be the best of the best. And they end up literally controlling most of Europe, as well as the Middle East and North Africa. The Romans go on to be the greatest civilization that comes out of Europe itself. And then the Romans go on to fight the Gauls, meet up and fight the Germans with some success and some failure, etc. But Hitler is looking for things that can be emulated and learned from. And so for him, the Romans and the Greeks are number one. Those are the people to emulate because they went to the highest levels. That becomes the critical issue here. I will return later because I've got tons of stuff to do, but I will return later to the German tribes and to the Gauls. And I want to show you some of the things that come out of them. There is something that I saw among the Germans, the ancient German tribes, that it doesn't seem to me anyone has noticed. There's some very interesting stuff about the German tribes and also about the Gauls, just to give you a feel for these other whites. Just because the Romans were the top of the pops in terms of technology, in terms of science, in terms of engineering, government, war, society, etc., doesn't mean that the other whites are total idiots with absolutely nothing to contribute. There is something that I've spotted from the Germans that is very interesting, and there is interesting stuff to be seen in the Gauls as well. So just because the Romans are by far the superpower doesn't mean everyone else is a total bozo and that everything they do is wrong. Like all whites, they've got interesting cultures and they've got strengths and weaknesses. And you'd be surprised, like I say, it's not quite as bad as Hitler's making it out, where he says, our ancestors just lived in mud huts while the Romans were building all these great things. Those whites were not like the blacks. They were not a bunch of dysfunctional idiots. They could stand their ground and they could fight back, and they weren't totally useless. So don't write those whites off. The barbarians are clever. If you saw that video that I did about Julius Caesar, about bravery can save you, cowardice can kill you, you will have seen there some of the interactions between the Gauls and the Germans and the Romans, and you will already have seen how sophisticated whites were, that even though the Romans were the top dogs, it wasn't like the Romans were just walking all over everybody with the greatest of ease. These other whites could give them a good hard time. Make no mistake, the Europeans, all Europeans could fight. They could really stand their ground against each other. And you would have seen how hard it was for the Romans at times. So don't think that the Romans just walked over everyone because everyone was a goofball. It's not the same as Africa. If you'll take a look at the photos on the screen in front of you, the above are the best examples I can find of recreations of what it seems like the buildings were like in the time of the pagan Germans. That seems to me to be the best. I struggled a lot to find photos, but this appears to be the best. This is a village that they created in Saxony. And if you look at it, it looks like most of the houses are made of wood. Maybe there is some kind of mud there, but it'll give you an idea that you are not looking at black African standards, okay? That whites were much, much more organized, and whites had all kinds of abilities. For them to create and build was not a problem. So it's not like they're a bunch of morons. And I will tell you, the ability of white men in the past to work with wood is quite amazing. They could get a lot of things done very quickly. Also, something else about Hitler. Hitler can at times be super critical. Like, I've read where Hitler speaks about Switzerland. And Switzerland is made up of Germans, French, and Italians who've created a country that they share, and Germans, French, and Italians are able to function in one country. And I've read where Hitler looks at Switzerland and he's disgusted by it. He's disgusted by it. I can't remember the exact words that he uses for Switzerland, but he's quite disgusted by it. And if you look at some of Hitler's criticisms, Hitler is very, very pedantic at times. At times, Hitler is very pedantic, and it's got to be exactly like this. And if it's not exactly like that, then he's quite irritated by it. you'll see that Hitler also felt a disgust towards the Austro-Hungarian Empire where he was born. And he's totally disgusted by it, wants nothing to do with it, and rather goes and moves to Germany. The first chance he gets, joins the army and stays there. He doesn't like this mixing even of whites. He doesn't even like the mixing of whites. He's that pedantic. So you need to take Hitler's words and you must see them in context. Sometimes he can be very, very pedantic on particular issues. So when Hitler starts getting all irritated by, oh God, you know, we can't let the world know that we had nothing. You know, he's going a little bit overboard. He wants the Germans to have been better in the past, but he's just a little bit, he wants too much out of his people, and the past just isn't what he'd like it to be. But he himself, he wants to make a fantastic future. And so that's why he's more interested in all these others who did great things. And you can see that Hitler borrows from the Romans heavily. If you will look on the screen in front of you, you'll see a bunch of photos of Hitler's plans for his capital after the war, his plans for Germania. And if you look at Germania, Germania is totally Roman. There on the top left is an obelisk. There on the top right, you can see a beautiful Roman-style dome. I mean, the whole architecture of Hitler's stuff is very Roman. And you'll see it in lots and lots of the photos of Germany under the Nazis. You'll see all those Roman things. The eagle. The eagle is a Roman thing. The eagle, the style of the buildings, the style of the things that he has there. You'll see Roman, Roman, Roman all the way. So that is who he wants to emulate. And I have found it interesting to read where Hitler talks about the Roman legions, because he might well have thought highly of the Aryans, but I will tell you, he thought highly of the Roman legions as well. Maybe the Aryans in their chariots racing through Asia and conquering India were maybe his top heroes, but the Romans, the Roman legions are not far behind. The Roman legions are also a thing that Hitler admires. So when Hitler says, and it makes me smile, when Hitler says, oh God, you know, we have no history. We must hide it, you know, we must hide it because it's so bad. But if you go and you look around, nobody else is better off, you know. Maybe the Romans and the Greeks are ahead of the game, but the French, the British, the Poles, the people who become the Poles, the Vikings, the people in Scandinavia, they are no better. You know, they are no better. All those whites are in the same situation. All of those whites are more or less on a similar level. So it's not like Hitler has to panic and worry about the Germans being the bozos of Europe. It's not a valid comparison. Sometimes he goes a little bit over the top. I want to let you watch two German songs and you'll see why, because there is a German band that does songs, but it does songs from the past. I've seen a lovely one that they've done from like the Middle Ages, but they've done a bunch of songs from the distant past, from the sort of pagan times. And they seem to have attempted to try to use musical instruments that are more or less true to that time, though there are some musical instruments that I'm not so sure about. I think there are a couple of musical instruments there that did not exist in those times. But they kind of dress up and they show what Germans were like back then. And in the first song, if you look carefully, in the distant background, you'll see what appears to be a German village. But this sort of, let's call it historically accurate or historically semi-accurate music and so on, may give you a little bit of an idea of maybe sort of how the Germans were back then. And I don't see any big problems with it. They might not have been on the level of the Romans, but they weren't a bunch of fools. I like the second song a lot more than the first one. In the second song, they are at a very interesting location in Germany. And if you look on the screen in front of you, you'll see a photo of it. It's called something like Externsteiner. Externsteiner would almost be the way I'd pronounce it in Afrikaans. And it's really an amazing rock formation. And they even built a bridge there, I think in the 1800s. But people can walk around that place. It's really, really amazing. That Boer Nazi that I knew, Leon Hart actually took his wife to that place. He took her to Germany and he specifically took her to that place as well before he married her. But it's a hell of an amazing rock formation, that thing. And it's like you can walk around and through and on it. I don't know how it works exactly, but it's really something stunning. And they do say that prehistoric people would have seen that as like a special place. You know, it has got some kind of special meaning. But just as a rock formation, it's freaking big and it's pretty damn awesome. And it features in the second song. So here are the two songs and you'll get a little bit of an idea of maybe a bit of pre-Christian, pagan Germans, maybe a little bit of an idea of sort of what they were like.
lässt den morgendlichen Schein ziehen die Vögel, oh, mögen sie wohl morgen sein. Ich folge dem Rauschen der Schwingen in der Stille Mond. Uralte Lieder dringen aus den Nebeln vor.
Now that you've got a little bit of a feel for the Germans from pagan times, I just want to show you a little bit about the Romans, and then I think you'll begin to see why someone like Hitler, who studied the Romans intensely, why he was so impressed with the Romans. The Romans, to me, are the greatest thing of the last 2,500 years. And the Romans are so amazing that every single Western country has benefited from and copies the Romans. The Romans literally define all of our current civilization, even right now. The United States is built specifically on the Roman model, the Roman Republic. But all of the West, all of the West, is built on things that come from the Roman Empire. I'm not joking with you. The Roman Empire has defined us. And you will see in every single Western country that important buildings are still built on Roman architecture. Not because it's the easiest way to build it. It's just that that's the standard. That is what officialdom looks like. It is a thing that we got from the Romans and we've kept it. But there's lots of stuff that we've gotten from the Romans. Lots and lots. In fact, our civilization, even now, is basically Roman. But the excellence of the Romans truly comes through only after you've really studied them. I've been trying for quite a long time to really get a grip on the Romans and the Roman mindset. And I did one little video about the Romans in this regard, but I'm coming back and I'm going to show you even more about the Romans. Because when you understand the Romans, you will understand why they are successful. You'll begin to grasp why liberals and Jews want to hide certain parts of Roman culture and Roman thinking. Because the Romans were very, very interesting people. And they did not achieve what they achieved by accident. In fact, there are some things that make me think that even though all of our nations are built on, let's call it Roman principles, that we are very, very, very weak, and that our civilization is nothing like Roman civilization in certain respects. But you need to get into their minds and understand the Romans, and that's something we're going to do shortly. But just to give you a little something to look at and to ponder in the final section of this video, I just want to show you two Roman achievements that I think are very impressive. The Romans had engineering down to a T. They did incredible civil engineering, but the Roman army is probably the army that did more engineering than any other army in the history of the world. The Roman army was the leader in engineering technology for military purposes. Those Romans were just astounding what they could do and what they could build. And those Romans functioned without engines. They didn't have steam engines. They didn't have petrol engines. They didn't have anything that gave them mechanical power. So they still got things done, but how they solved their problems is quite astounding. So I want to show you two sets of things as we wind up this video. If you look on the screen in front of you, on the top left, you are looking at the Colosseum. So that is the Roman equivalent of modern sports stadiums. But the Colosseum was a couple of stories high. The Romans invented cement. The Roman cement is so good that Roman cement outlasts modern cement. There are lots of Roman buildings that still stand to this day, and they're built with Roman cement. That's just one of many, many things the Romans came up with. But the problem was, how do you build a building a couple of stories high in those times? How did the Romans build multi-story buildings? And one of the things that I looked into, which I found quite astounding, was that Romans had cranes. Whites were using cranes a long time ago. The Greeks, I think, started with cranes, and then the Romans took it to the next level. And on that screen in front of you on the right is an academic diagram of a Roman crane. And the Roman crane lifts up weights by having people push and pull those spokes that you see there. And from my understanding, when the Romans built multi-story buildings, they not only had cranes on the ground, but they also had cranes standing higher up. So you'd have one crane lifting something to a higher level, and then another crane picking it up from that higher level and moving it to the next higher level. So you had cranes that were high up. And these things could break, and these things are dangerous. But this is how the Romans lifted heavy weights several stories high. So that is the one thing that I want to show you. There are going to be three little videos for you to watch. The first video is a video about aqueducts. Rome was the first city in the world that had 1 million people living there. So when you've got so many people living together in a small space, you now run into all kinds of problems, especially health problems. The Romans knew that one of the key things that you need to maintain good health was good, clean water. So how do the Romans manage to get water into this enormous city? And what they basically end up doing is they create a system of flowing water, which in part runs through aqueducts. But they basically bring water from many miles away into Rome, and the water flows into Rome all the time. Because they don't have pumps that they can switch on and off, they now have flowing water that flows into Rome all the time. And throughout the city, they've got drinking fountains with running water, water that's running through there all the time. And they've got baths, they've got sewage, they have got a bunch of stuff. And the water is running through the pipes into the city, distributing across the city, and people are able to get water, drink water, clean themselves, have baths, go to the toilets, all that kind of stuff. And they had this stuff 2,000 years ago. They had freaking public toilets. They had sewage, all that kind of stuff they had. And they didn't have chemical energy or steam energy to drive this. They used gravity. And in order to do this, they needed to be able to do engineering extremely well. So the first video will show you just a little bit. It's a minute and a half. In a minute and a half, you'll get a little bit of a summary of the amazing, absolutely stunning engineering of the Roman aqueducts. The Romans had to have their water flow at a very, very slight incline. It had to be extremely precise so that it doesn't go too fast, too slow, etc., etc. And they could build and make things absolutely dead on accurate for miles and miles and miles. Through tunnels, over valleys, you name it. They did it with a precision that is beyond imagination. So that's the first thing you'll see. The next thing you'll see is a little video from Britain, and you'll see these British whites. They have built a small model of a Roman crane, and they've got a guy who's a stonemason. And by the way, stonemasonry is yet another skill of white people that we've completely forgotten. Our people know how to work with stone in ways that you cannot even imagine. And in this section, you'll see them using that old technology, and you'll see a stonemason creating something that's got quite a bit of weight, and then they use their little Roman crane to lift it up and to show you how this thing works. Because it's too heavy for a man to lift, and they're doing this as an exercise. And you will see a little bit about, take a look at the tools of the stonemason, take a look at the techniques of the stonemason. How did our ancestors do these things? And you will see all the kinds of things that they invented. You know, our ancestors, all of them, including the pagans, they had lots and lots of tools, eh? White men had lots and lots of tools. And the Romans had more tools than anybody else. So the second video is the small Roman crane and an example of it actually working. But the Romans, as per this diagram, had really big cranes. Now, before we got steam power, after the Roman Empire had fallen, we still kept on using cranes in Europe. And castles and big buildings were built with wooden cranes. but their mechanisms were different. They worked on a treadmill principle, and people got inside the crane and they would walk, and that is how the crane worked. And so the final video, you'll see a crane that was built in France. It's based on a medieval crane. These are the kinds of cranes that they used to use to build cathedrals and churches and castles. And again, it's the same principle. A crane lifts it up to another level, and you've got another crane higher up. They even have the cranes on the roof. And imagine the kind of danger and the kind of building accidents that Whites could have had and probably did have in the past. But this crane in France, they use this crane, and you'll see two guys powering that crane, and they lift a car. So you'll get an idea that those old wooden cranes could lift some freaking heavy weights. So whenever you see anything about Whites, even before we had steam and petrol and diesel and rockets and all that kind of stuff, our people were getting things done that nobody else on the planet was getting done. Even when we lacked all those other technologies, we could still get all sorts of things done. So check out these three little videos. They're not long. And walk away with a appreciation for how Whites got things done in the past. And all of this stuff is really either outright Roman or later derivatives and copies with improvements of what had come from the Romans. And these things worked and built fabulous buildings and other structures for thousands of years. The white man has always had a plan and a method to do amazing stuff. And in this regard, I got to tell you, I saw a video recently, and it is the most retarded video that I've seen in a long time. I was horrified by the stupidity of some modern Whites when it comes to ancient things. I will tackle that separately. You will not believe how stupid some people have become, and how little knowledge they have about how awesome our ancestors were. There are people that really need a wake up. I saw something out of the white right that just defied stupidity. I'd never seen anything so ridiculous. And it does relate to these kinds of things. So just go and take a look at the white man, and how the white man has always had a plan and a method, and he could get things done. And it'll make you appreciate those old buildings that were built in the past.
The Romans engineered their aqueducts to approach the city on a gradual declining angle, or gradient. That gradient was just several inches every 100 feet. To maintain the water's precise descent through high mountains, Roman engineers dug perfectly angled tunnels through them. When the pipelines reached low valleys, they were elevated on stone walls. If the walls needed to be higher than 6.5 feet off the ground, the Romans saved building materials while still adding strength by perfecting an ancient engineering concept, the arch. Arches were built around a temporary wooden framework that held each stone in place until the keystone was laid in the center. The keystone evenly distributed weight down each side of the arch, allowing builders to stack additional stones above it. A 6-mile column of arches carried the Aqua Claudia across the valleys on its way to Rome. After reaching the city, each aqueduct emptied into 3 holding tanks. One for the public drinking fountains, a second for the public baths, and a third reserved for the emperor and other wealthy Romans who paid for their own running water.
Over in the park, stonemason Giles MacDonald is making his own pile of rubble. And with the arrival of members of the Ermine Street Guard, the place is beginning to look like a Roman building site. Giles, your task over the next couple of days is to make us a Roman column, isn't it?
Not quite a whole Roman column. A bit of one, though.
Is this it?
No, this is part of it. We've got a base over here.
Uh-huh.
So the two together, I mean, they'll stand about 4 or 5 feet high.
When you've finished, will you carve it on the outside or will you leave it smooth like that?
Well, actually, what he's going to do is carve some overlapping leaves on the outside, because there's a particular sort of column, which was found in this part of the town. And this column was made to stand out in the open and carry a statue of Jupiter, or sometimes of a rider god, so they're usually called Jupiter columns.
So presumably it would have stood higher than this?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It would have looked, in fact, more or less like that.
So beautiful, isn't
well,
it?
I mean, it's wonderful. It'd be nice to make one of those, but it's rather too much work.
Having made it, we then got to lift it up and get it on top of the base.
Who's going to do that?
Not me.
Is that the
smart ones over there? Yeah. That's the ones.
Chris?
Hello.
How are you going to get that cylindrical column on top of that base?
Well, hopefully we're going to reproduce a Roman crane, an A-frame crane. And if we've done all our calculations correctly, we've worked it out that we'll be able to lift that onto the column base.
The Romans were noted for many things, but I'm not sure calculation or carpentry were among them. Over in the park, the crowds are gathering. The Ermine Street guard appear to have finished the crane. It's all very well lifting a centurion, but will it be strong enough to lift over half a ton of solid stone?
Jones, this is going really well, and I see you've pressed Victor into service as well.
Not a trade, Phil, not a trade.
He's doing a great job, though.
He's a natural craftsman,
he is.
Isn't he?
He is.
I mean, this is amazing. I mean, I think when I saw this before, all I saw was, well, you hadn't started it. It was just
block.
A square block of stone. And now you've got this beautifully ornamented cylinder of stone, and it's got to go on there, hasn't it? On
that's
the actual base of that
thing,
column.
Yeah.
So we got the cylinder. I know we're going to use a crane, but how the hell do you attach the crane to the cylinder?
Uh-huh. Very clever little device.
Yeah?
That sits in the top, called a Lewis pin.
A Lewis pin?
A Lewis pin. And that goes in the top of the stone.
Instinct tells me that if that goes in there like that...
That's it.
Yeah. And then as that tautens up...
That's it.
Oh, I see.
Sort of a scissor effect.
That goes in the hole, and as you take up the tension, those ends pull apart and actually pinch in the hole.
It's very simple technology, but it works.
Come on, then. It's now or never. Give it a go.
Stop. Good. Stop.
Despite the creaking timbers and creaking joints, the crane performs perfectly. Amazing considering it was crafted using only original materials and hand tools. Before the column can be left in the park as a permanent reminder of our visit, Giles inscribes it in the best Latin translation of Time Team. A mile after mile after mile and getting absolutely nowhere. Well, that's what it would have been like for the poor workers trapped inside that. Which brings me to my next worst job, the treadmill worker. I've travelled all the way to Normandy in France to see this replica, which has been designed using medieval illustrations as a guide. It was the treadmill that provided the power for the medieval crane, so if you were the one doing the treading, it was a pretty menial task, but it was crucially important. The medieval crane builders had two alternatives. They could either build a small wheel, which was pulled around from the outside, or else they could make a much bigger wheel, which was powered by two people inside. The bigger wheels could lift the larger loads, but this was new technology. The cranes were really experimental, and there was always the danger that they might collapse. So working inside that wheel could be really dangerous. The treadmill workers were the unwitting guinea pigs at the centre of a technological marvel. The cranes were built by trial and error, often breaking and killing people, then being modified and rebuilt. But they must have been pretty effective, or the buildings wouldn't have been possible at all. Medieval illustrations seem to suggest that the crane was actually lifted onto the top of the cathedral as it was being built. So the craftsmen must have had some sort of way of lifting the crane up in pieces, maybe using smaller cranes or possibly a windlass. Here at Ormby, you can see that the walls are absolutely peppered with these little holes, which would have been for scaffolding. So as the walls got higher, so the scaff went higher, and the crane went up and up and up until it was right on the very top of the cathedral itself. This was technology that had been around since the Greeks and the Romans, but it had been completely lost in Western Europe until the Normans and the French went over to Constantinople and brought it back. In fact, it was these machines alone that enabled the great medieval cathedrals to be built, because they were the only way that people at that time had of lifting massive blocks of stone the size of a car. And in fact, it's this car that we're going to lift. Michel, Frank, Ellie, how does this work?
This crane works very easily. You know, it's the rope is driving by the big wheels, but the rope is attached to the axle of the wheels.
The way the crane works is pretty simple. The rope is attached to the axle in the middle of the treadmill, and in order to lift the car just 1 metre, the axle has to turn at least 2 or 3 times. Because the diameter of the treadmill is so much greater, the amount of effort you have to put in to get the car to budge is spread out over a longer distance. It's like using a low gear to pedal a bike uphill.
These guys are almost ready. Should we get in?
Yes.
Are you ready, guys?
Michael and Frank, vous pouvez monter dans la voiture?
They're getting in while it goes up. They'll be able to take that weight as well?
Yeah, oh, easily. This crane can take twice weight than we have actually, you know?
We can take 2 tons?
Oh, yeah, easy.
Which way, this way?
Okay, to lift, we go this way.
Right.
We don't have to rush, you know?
Yeah.
Working slowly, we'll do the job anyway.
Oh, it's going now. Look, it's really going up now. Who are the people who would have been doing this treading?
Most of the time they use blind people.
Blind people?
Yes.
Why was that?
To secure the whole process, because if you turn inside too much, you will feel some kind of attraction for the emptiness.
You mean that if you're blind, you don't look down 300
right.
foot and see the terrible fall that awaits you?
Right.
That was very sympathetic of them, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one way to... they can serve the community.
Do you think they
were working for God, you know, building cathedrals?
Do you think they worked barefoot?
Oh, yes, because they didn't have shoes at the time.
It's going up now, isn't it? Look at that. See? You can feel the tug. You can feel there's more weight on it now, but
yeah.
It's not too difficult.
Whoa.
Should we stop now? So we turn around and put them down again?
No, cut the rope. Faster.
Oh, this is no problem.
Yeah, slowly.
Oh, okay.
Ah, we stop. A small problem here.
Everything seemed so safe and easy until this apparently solid machine suddenly began to come apart at the axle.
Michael, Frank, pouvez descendre et sécuriser l'axe. Il est en train de partir.
So the axle comes out and
yes.
the wheel
and we can go down
out.
To the 30 meter down.
I suddenly got an inkling of what being a treadmill worker must have been like. Imagine being 200 foot up in the air and blind and suddenly realizing things are starting to fall apart.
Non, celui-là, il va pas venir tant qu'il a pas bloqué.
This all may seem pretty safe, like a couple of hamsters going around in a wheel, but when you're in here, it doesn't feel like that at all. You have no control over this thing. You can't just stop it and break it, and you can't just put your hand out to stop it either, because you're frightened that as it whips past one of these things, it's going to slice your fingers off. And when you try to bring it to a halt, the damn thing just keeps moving and moving and moving, and it's wet, and it's slippy. So when it's just going along fine, well, that's just like you're on holiday, but as soon as there's a problem, is it okay now?
Yeah, now it's pretty safe. We can finish the jobs.
Okay, let's get
no
down.
No problems. We're going down that way.
Yeah, I'm keeping my hands in my pocket.
After now. You, gentlemen.
It's keeping, getting the rhythm right that is difficult, isn't it, for two people? I feel really nervous now.
Really?
I can hear the creaking on my left ear.
No, come on. Okay. It's the safest machine we have ever made, but we made only one.
Thank you for that. Finding out about some of these jobs has been bad enough.
So how were those videos, hey? All those things that give you a little bit of insight into what whites were like in the past. And did you see the stonemasonry? Kinds of things that white men used to do. And the simple but brilliant inventions that they came up with to deal with this, deal with that. Look at that metal hook that is inserted into a hole in the stone. And when you pull on it, then the act of pulling on it causes it to hold on to the stone, and then you can lift a very, very heavy weight with no weird, fancy stuff, eh? Lots and lots of brilliant, brilliant things come from our past that we have got no appreciation for, just no appreciation whatsoever. And stonemasonry is actually an amazing thing that our ancestors did a lot of. They could work with rock, solid rock, and the things that could come out of it. And you could see there that those stonemasons, those modern stonemasons, those Englishmen, look at what a nice thing they can produce just using those tools. Those old tools are tried and tested, and they work very, very well. And the little cranes and so forth. And how were the stories about the cranes and the difficulties that relate to those cranes as used in the Middle Ages when you walk inside of them and they can collapse. And even more bizarre is that if you're busy building a cathedral or a castle or whatever, they have to lift those cranes up. And those cranes are sitting maybe 200 feet in the air, and it's made of wood and metal, and the crane can break, and the crane can either crush you, or you and the crane can come tumbling down to your death. And then, did you hear about the story of who the people were that worked those cranes? The people who worked those cranes, they often used blind people. So a blind white person is then given that job. The blind white person will not become dizzy and will not become disorientated. But the blind white person is working maybe 200 feet up in the air and can be torn to pieces and killed. And then there were obviously accidents and whites died. So, you know, in this modern world, in this modern, disgusting world of uselessness and Jewish weakness and all kinds of weirdness, okay? All of those things would now be outlawed and you wouldn't be allowed to do it, etc., etc. Our ancestors did not have these luxuries. Our ancestors were merely trying to get jobs done with what they had. And injury and death was part and parcel of life. And white people weren't a bunch of pussies and a bunch of crybabies who moaned and groaned all the time. These are fantastic luxuries that are possible nowadays because we have created so much awesome, awesome industry and infrastructure that now we can allow all kinds of buffoons and fools to do all sorts of things which 50 or 100 years ago, they would not have been able to do. But they can do it because of our machinery, our wondrous inventions. I get so irritated with these people who scream and cry and all this fake morality about fake hardships and all that kind of stuff. Our ancestors lived and died and did hard things. They overcame and solved so many problems. And it could mean that you get your fingers ripped off or your bones crushed or some other nasty thing. But out of all of that struggle came the wonderful thing that is Western civilization. And to be frank with you, I've got no time for these nation-wrecking, civilization-wrecking rubbish who walk around and are constantly tearing us down and tearing our ancestors down, etc. The white race has done more on this planet than everybody else put together. There is one mistake I made in my commentary. I kept saying Roman cement, when I actually meant Roman concrete. So what I really meant to say was all those wonderful things were built with Roman concrete, and Roman concrete is fantastic, and it has lasted, and there are buildings that are 2,000 years old, buildings and parts of buildings that are 2,000 years old made with Roman concrete. Wonderful stuff. Just one of a number of amazing things that come out of the Romans. Lots and lots of good things come out of the Romans. And if you understand our life now and you understand the life of the Romans 2,000 years ago, you'll actually be shocked and amazed at how similar our modern lives are to those of the Romans. The Romans created most of what we have, and most of our culture and methods and ways of organizing and ways of doing things is actually Roman. And Hitler was aware of this. Napoleon was a huge student of the Romans. The founding fathers of America were huge students of the Romans and the Greeks. That's how you learn from those who came before. And the Romans are a wonderful, wonderful model. I will be discussing the Romans in many different ways, and then you will begin to realize the absolute awesomeness of the Romans, because the civilization that the Romans produced was the greatest thing that we have done. When you understand some of the deeper issues, you'll start to realize, you know what, these people were awesome, like really awesome. And from a national and civilizational viewpoint, the way they thought and the way they tried to do things is actually wonderful. And that is what has allowed us to be able to progress so much. And rest assured, Hitler knew all of these things. Hitler had studied history inside out. He knew the importance of the Romans. And if you look carefully at the Third Reich, you'll see lots and lots of examples of Roman influence, especially in architecture and layout and so forth. And of course, the eagle, the Roman eagle. The Roman eagle is not only Hitler's eagle, it is Napoleon's eagle that his soldiers took into battle. Napoleon had eagles like the Roman legions. And it's the same eagle as the American eagle. The American eagle is nothing more than another version of the Roman eagle. It's the Romans that were big into this eagle thing. I don't know of other whites who were big into using the eagle as their most important symbol. So let's end with something that is uplifting and funny and true. It is actually yet another piece of excellence from the English, from the Brits. You're going to see something performed in the UK. I don't know the actual hall where it is being performed, but it's very grand and it looks really beautiful. And you're going to see the British at their finest. You're going to see a huge orchestra, large numbers of singers, and you're going to see real quality music, first-class singing, excellent performances. And what it is it's a song that comes out of a production called The Life of Brian. And what is happening is that it is a musical version of a discussion in the original Life of Brian. In this discussion, what comes up is that there's this guy, and he is one of the, let's say, locals, and he's worked up about the Romans. The Romans rule them. And he turns around and he says, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" Now, in many ways, by the way, this same discussion about the Romans is a discussion that the blacks in Africa could have had with regard to the whites. What have the whites ever done for us? And same thing for all the other races who like to criticize us. So in this case, here he is, and he's saying, you know, what have the Romans ever done for us? And then after a while, somebody turns around and says, you know, the aqueducts, they gave us the aqueducts. And then he says, yeah, that is true. And then he goes on and he starts again and he's like, you know, the Romans this, the Romans that, what have the Romans done for us? And then someone else pipes up and says, you know, the roads. And so this discussion continues. And you'll see as this discussion carries on and on and on, what actually comes out of this discussion. And by the time it gets to the end, you will start realizing that, you know what? The Romans did a huge amount of stuff for us. And when I look at that discussion could have taken place in Africa because the answers would be exactly the same. And probably that same discussion could have taken place on many continents where there are all kinds of ingrates and people who dislike whites, and it would be a very similar discussion where instead of the Romans, you can say, what did the whites bring us? And then you'll actually get answers. Oh, they brought us roads. They did this. They did that. They did that. And so it carries on. But this is brilliantly executed. Brilliantly executed. This is the English at their finest. Absolutely tip-top, first-class, real well done, and the whole thing comes out. It's fantastically performed, absolute white excellence from end to end, and it's damn funny too. So it's extremely well done, and it's a good laugh. But that little discussion relates back to the Romans, and it's just a tiny little piece of what the Romans have done for us. And in actual fact, all whites have contributed to the excellence that we have and are, but the Romans need a special place because, man, they did a lot of stuff. And our current existing nation states are all built on mostly things that came from Rome. And that is why we will revisit the Romans and try to get into their minds to try and understand how did these people think? Because when you understand how they thought, then you will walk away and you'll say, that is awesome. In the same way that when you understand the Nazis, you'll say, that is incredible. But you'll see that the Romans are whites who pulled off some amazing feats, really amazing feats. And the things that they did are things that we have benefited from. We as a race are richer, much richer, as a direct result of the Romans. And I could add as a final point that for 1,000 years we forgot about the Romans. We lived in darkness. And our modern high-tech and super high-tech civilization is a direct result of rediscovering the Romans. Rediscovering our ancient past, the Romans and the Greeks. We, for 1,000 years, were a race living in ignorance. And when we rediscovered the knowledge of our ancestors, it enabled us to unleash the current wonderful, amazing, incredible technological marvels that you see around you. And of course, Hitler knew all these things. He knew all this stuff. you will not find Hitler being unaware of all these things. Remember, Hitler read every book in the library. He would know all about these things. He'd know about the Renaissance. He knows about the history of our race, all the way from ancient times to modern times. And he appreciated it, and he saw the wonderful things that you can learn from it, and then take that and take it to the next level. And that's the kind of stuff that we should do. So here it is, and have a good laugh. It's really, really good. And it's an example also of white excellence at its finest. In this case, from the British.
The Romans are all bastards. They have bled us till we're white. They've taken everything we've got as if it was their right. And we've got nothing in return, though they make so much fuss. What have the Romans ever done for us?
What have the Romans? What have the Romans? What have the Romans ever done for us?
The aqueduct?
What?
They gave us the aqueduct.
Oh, yes, they did give us that, that's true.
And sanitation.
Yes, that's true.
The aqueduct or grant is one thing the Romans may have done.
And the roads now, they're all new.
And the great ways too.
Well, apart from the wines and fermentation.
And the canals for navigation.
Public health for all our nation.
Apart from those which are a plus. What have the Romans ever done for us?
What have the Romans? What have the Romans? What have the Romans ever done for us?
The baths?
What?
The public baths?
Yes.
The public baths are a great delight.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night.
And medicine.
Irrigation.
Roman law.
And education.
The circus for our delectation.
And the gladiation.
Well, apart from medicine, irrigation, health, roads, cheese, and education, baths and the circus maximus, what have the Romans ever done for us?
What have the Romans? What have the Romans? What have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, shut up!
Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon.
Give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you will.